So Elijah has got it all together. Things are going his way. He's the prophet in charge. He's confronting kings and followers of Baal like it's his job, because it is. He's performing miracles. He even calls lightning down from heaven. That's a pretty darn good day when you're a prophet. So what's up with the Elijah we see in today's reading? He's intimidated by his opponents. He's dogged by self-doubt. He's generally grumpy that things aren't going his way. Maybe it's something even a little bit deeper, a little more serious than that. Elijah talks about wanting his life to end. So we read from 1 Kings in chapter 19, starting in verse 4, is printed in your bulletin. You might also follow along in your pew Bibles. I think I'm going to go past verse 8. So if you want to follow along, go ahead and turn to to the Bible in front of you. But Elijah himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up, eat." Elijah looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him, and said, "Get up, eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. At that place he came to a cave, and he spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Elijah answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." He said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting the mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance to the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Elijah answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenants, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." Then the Lord said to Elijah, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram. Also, you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you shall anoint several more people in several more places. Yet, I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth who has not kissed him." The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So how did Elijah get to this point, alone in the cave? Where did things start falling apart? Well, there's King Ahab, the ruler of the northern tribes of Israel. His wife, Queen Jezebel, get to talking, and it's not favorable for Elijah. In fact, it's Jezebel that's really set off by the work that Elijah has been doing, that Elijah has been called to do by God. And so her response is to send a messenger to Elijah with a death threat. A death threat that she says will be fulfilled in one day. What would you do if you were Elijah? You can get the heck out of town. Elijah is terrified. He's fleeing for his life. And so he goes to Beersheba. Legally speaking, Beersheba is under Judah's control, which should mean that Queen Jezebel can't get to him there. And Elijah figures, well, now is probably a pretty good time to start talking to God about what's been going on. And so Elijah spends these 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness. This might sound familiar, in fact. And you know, the thing I think that resonates with me most, thinking about Elijah's journey, his fleeing, hiding in the cave, going out into the wilderness, is how real Elijah is willing to be with God. Elijah is miserable, and God is persistent. Elijah is discouraged about how he's being treated. That's probably understating it a little bit. He feels like he's a failure. He's realizing that his job isn't only a danger to his health, it's actually now a threat on his life. And it's God who set him up to this whole prophet gig to begin with. So thanks for that, God. Elijah just wants out. God persists. God refuses to let Elijah off the hook. Elijah's ready to be done. This is not what he signed up for. He feels alone. He's being persecuted. He's angry. God persists. God called Elijah, and God is not going to give up on him. Elijah rails. He has done his job and then some. He's been zealous for the Lord, which is the biblical way, I think, of saying in today's language, being a little extra for God. And so Elijah goes to Mount Sinai because he wants to confront God face to face. God persists. God sends angels. God sends food, which I have to think might be the origin of the church's tradition of bringing casseroles when someone is going through a hardship in their life. Because let's face it, Elijah's not in a good place at this point. If anybody needs a casserole, it's Elijah. One of the biggest book studies that I've ever facilitated was with our new young adult group in my first call. We'd been meeting regularly to serve. We'd serve dinner at the park across the street from the church to folks experiencing homelessness. We would go do social things together, bowling, breweries, you name it. But this was the first time that we had tried a book study, and we weren't really sure what to expect. What I didn't anticipate was driving to Barnes & Noble's all over Kansas City, trying to track down enough copies of Rabbi Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, so that everybody who wanted a copy could have one. I did not see that coming. I think in 2008 was like before Amazon Prime. I was trying to think why I'd possibly be driving to Barnes & Noble's, but we had over 20 people that night. People in their 20s and 30s who met to discuss the book, which was far more people than we'd ever had at any one event before, all to read this book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Maybe there's a little bit of Elijah in all of us. Sometimes we too rail against God when bad stuff overwhelms us. We too can't help but wonder why bad things happen to good people, to godly people. You'll notice that Kushner's best-selling book, this was written in the 80s, but obviously still popular today, it's not titled, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, but When. Now, we'd no doubt have to do some theological gymnastics to find out the former. Why do bad things happen to good people? But when acknowledges that hard stuff, we might call it bad stuff, it's part of this life. It comes standard with our particular make and model as human beings. Kushner wrote the book as a response to a personal tragedy in his life. The day after their daughter Ariel's second birthday, their older son, Aaron, was diagnosed with, it's a very rare disease. It causes premature aging. It's the disease that Benjamin Button had. It's only one child in every 7 or 8 million who's affected by it, and its cause is largely unknown, but essentially a child becomes prematurely old. And so Aaron died just 2 days after his 14th birthday. Kushner's hope in publishing the book was to help people who have been hurt by life find a faith that could actually help them through the bad stuff rather than making things worse. And he says he couldn't write the book right away. It took him time to process what had happened to his family, what had happened to their son. It took space to wrestle with the anger and intense grief he felt. He didn't write this book as a way to somehow skirt around it. He could only write the book once he had gone through it. Elijah and Kushner shared this in common: their faith, even if shaken, in the God of Israel. And more than that, the God of Israel's steadfast presence with them. Kushner begins by confessing that the day they received Aaron's diagnosis, his brain was like a broken record. All he could think about again and again was, this can't be happening. It's not how the world's supposed to work. Tragedies like this are supposed to happen to selfish, dishonest people whom I, as a rabbi, would then try to comfort by assuring them of God's forgiving love. How can this be happening to me, to my son, if what I believed about the world is true? Kushner acknowledges what Elijah seems to at least temporarily have forgotten. Anguish and heartbreak may not be distributed evenly throughout the world, but they are distributed widely. Everyone gets their share, which is not to diminish Elijah's or your pain. No one wins the suffering Olympics. We each bear our own pain, and to minimize it by trying to compare ourselves to others' pain and suffering, that does us no good. This is only to say, you're not alone. You're not alone. So God establishes this with Elijah, reminding him, hey, I'm here. I've been here all along. I am not going anywhere. But then God goes one step further. God gives Elijah the strength to go on, in the form of bread and water, angels. God tells Elijah to go to the mountain. I'm about to pass you by, God says. And God does, not in the wind, not in the earthquake, not in the fire. God shows up for Elijah in the silence. Prayer, Rabbi Kushner says, redeems us from isolation. It assures us that we need not feel alone or abandoned. Prayer lets us know that we are part of a greater reality with more depth, more hope, more courage, and more of a future than any one of us could have ourselves. God shows up in the silence. Not that all prayer has to be silent, mind you. People who pray for courage, for strength to bear the unbearable, for the grace to remember what they have left instead of what they have lost, discover they have more strength and more courage than they ever knew themselves to have. Their prayers, Kushner says, help them tap into these hidden reserves of faith and courage that we all have, but that we just may not always be able to reach. Our promise, he writes, is that we are not alone in our pain, and more than that, we are able to draw on a source outside of ourselves for the strength and courage we need to survive life's tragedies and unfairness. Now, we may be living nearly 3,000 years after Elijah, but we find our strength, our hope, our patience from the same source, the God who did not fail the Israelites, does not fail us today. There's a 19th century Hasidic rabbi who once said, human beings are God's language. God doesn't show opposition to birth defects or cancer by eliminating them or by making them happen only to bad people, Kushner writes. Rather, God summons forth friends and neighbors to ease the burden and fill the emptiness. Rabbi Kushner describes a man who built a little miniature scaled-down tennis racket that was just Aaron's size, or the woman who gave to Aaron a family heirloom, an extra small violin. There were the children who would play with Aaron and who would overlook his physical appearance, his physical limitations. They wouldn't let him get away with not playing by the rules. People like that, Kushner says, were God's language to their family, a reminder that they were not alone. They were not cast off. When we show up for one another when we're hurting, even when we're not sure if we have the right thing to say, maybe we can't come up with anything to say at all, but we show up, we're there, we're present, then in those moments, we are God's language. When we sit and listen to someone else, even if it's just listening to the silence, we are God's language. When we fix something that's broken, the faucet, the toilet, maybe it's not the thing, the big thing that's broken, but it's fixing something that's broken, that goes a long way, and that is God's language. When we cook a casserole, that's God's language too. When we write a card or we send a text to let someone know that we're thinking of them, we're praying with them, we're praying for them. Just as simple and short as that. That's God's language. When we attend the funeral, the baseball game, the orchestra concert, anytime we show up because we know it matters to someone else, we are God's language. When we invite someone to share a meal with us, to break bread together, we are God's language. And God didn't just speak to and through the prophets of old, like Elijah. God is still speaking.